What we hadn't counted on, what I hadn't thought about, was this almost sacred feeling that you get when you go into that clan house.
Dedicating the new Walter Sobeleff Building in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, tempers flare at a land into trust committee hearing in Washington.
If you take this path against the people of Indian Country, the Obama administration will be standing shoulder to shoulder with tribes and tribal organizations as they fight you on this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Two families are suing the Anchorage School District for what they allege are illegal suspension practices. The mothers say the suspension notices the district sends out don't include the full reasons for the suspensions, just simplified codes like 74 dangerous actions or 14 willful disobedience. Jim Davis from the Northern Justice Project is arguing the case on behalf of the families. He says the incomplete notices violate due process rights because they don't give the families enough information to decide if they want to fight the decision or not.
You can't just put it on whichever families are the most aggressive or, whichever families make the most phone calls will find out what really happened. Families should be told in the beginning, here's what happened.
He says six families have brought up the issue to the Justice Project. Many of them do not speak English as a first language. Davis says this makes it harder for them to seek out the full reason. The suit is asking the district to change the policy and tell families the factual reasons behind any suspensions. The Anchorage School District says they do not comment on any active litigation. The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute unveiled its new structure in downtown Juneau today. It's called the Walter Sobeleff Building after the late Tlingit scholar, elder, and religious leader. Inside stands a full-sized replica of a traditional red cedar clan house. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has the story on how this multi-purpose building also became a sacred space.
At the opening ceremony, the Angoon Yakti dance in their regalia in front of the Walter Sobeleff Building. Davina Cole is the arts assistant here. She clutches her four-month-old baby girl tightly to her chest.
We're a young Yidi from the Taku Kwan area, and we're little wolves. She's my baby pup.
Cole says she's looking forward to what the Sobeleff Building will offer her daughter. They've already gone to a baby Raven Reads class before the grand opening. It teaches pre-literacy through native stories.
So even right now, she's benefiting from the center. It's going to be really good for her to be surrounded by that and having a place to even go and learn that.
The building is a museum for Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian artifacts, a space for cultural ceremonies, and a gift shop. It's part of an initiative to turn Juneau into the Northwest Native Arts Capital. But designing a space that could serve all of those functions and reflect the past was difficult.
When we got the responses, the designs were all very traditional.
Rosita Worrell is the president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and a Tlingit from the Eagle Moiety. She says the Native Artist Committee wanted a structure that was more traditionally inspired.
They don't like the word contemporary, so we wanted that kind of feel to it.
SHI sifted through submissions and picked architect Paul Volkers. The design was influenced by the form of ceremonial clan houses with chunky beams of yellow cedar. It has an open feel and a wall of glass at the entrance.
I will tell you that we made the right decision in selecting Paul. It might not even have been the lowest bid, but we all said we've got to go with him.
As soon as you get off the phone, then you do your screaming and tell everybody, we're in.
Volker is the president of MRV Architects. The firm's founder, Lynn Forrest Sr., specialized in totem pole and clan house restoration.
The firm has sort of tried to maintain that legacy of involvement in the cultural design issues from Southeast ever since.
Most recently, MRV worked on a clan house in Kasan. For the Walter Sobeleff Building, Volkers looked at old photos of clan houses, Some were covered in moss from age.
But it would have the angles of the house, you know, the big massive beams on the front, and then sometimes the old house posts inside, and that became kind of the essential element that was left of these villages. And so what we tried to do in the new design was capture some of that heavy framework.
Volker shows me the basement level floor, which houses the research lab and mechanical room. The whole building is heated using wood pellets.
Big bag of the pellets. And it comes in through this sort of, looks like dryer duct or something, and just simply flows down like grain or something from the fill. There's a little fill portal up on the alley above us.
The building meets the U.S. Green Building Council's gold standard for energy efficiency. The wood pellets come mostly from Sea Alaska Corporation's land on Prince of Wales Island. Rosita Worrell says that's part of keeping the core cultural values in the design.
Ha'ani, our relationship to the land.
On the main floor is a full-sized replica of a clan house. It can seat 300 people and fits with tradition. Pitched roof, windowless, and built with adzed red cedar. The floor is tiered with sunken-in seating. Worrell says she knew it would be a special place.
But what we hadn't counted on, what I hadn't thought about, was this almost sacred feeling that you get when you go into that clan house.
She says that she has a strong connection to her ancestors.
It was almost like they were saying to us, you know, I know, Rosita, you know, you're talking about being progressive. You want to move into the 21st century. It almost became like their space. And they said, this is where we are.
At the Walter Sobolev's closing ceremony, the clan house was given the name Shukahit. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
The Interior Secretary's power to take land into trust for tribes could create pockets of Indian country across Alaska. Tribes see it as an opportunity to police their own territory and improve village safety. Others see it as the reservation model that Alaskans rejected in the Land Claims Settlement Act 44 years ago. Outside the state, land into trust is controversial too. Alaska Congressman Don Young presided over a testy hearing yesterday on the subject. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Early in the hearing, Congressman Young called out tribal advocates sitting in the audience. He said people from the National Congress of American Indians were trying to undermine him and the work of the Indian Affairs Subcommittee he chairs. Young said they were pouring gasoline on a political fire.
I'm going to suggest we play ball straight. This is not to start an issue or try to destroy the effects of this committee. I hope everybody understands that. I do not forgive very well when it comes to taking and destroying the aspects of this committee. Not once have I not served the American Indian Alaska Natives.
Young says he just wants to create uniform standards so the Interior Secretary doesn't have total discretion on when to take lands into trust. But Young's recent hearings on the subject and memos from his subcommittee staff have riled Indian country. Kevin Washburn, the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, says he worries Young's vision is a return to the darkest days of federal Indian policy. Washburn also spoke of an attack on tribal sovereignty and urged Young not to join it.
I respectfully ask you not to take this path. If you take this path against the people of Indian country, the Obama administration will be standing shoulder to shoulder with tribes and tribal organizations as they fight you on this.
The Secretary's land into trust power was granted by Congress in 1934. Washburn says the goal was to undo previous federal policy and reestablish tribal jurisdiction on some of the 90 million acres tribes lost.
Now, admittedly, Interior's power to take land into trust was used only rarely during the previous presidential administration. But when President Obama came into office, he made restoring tribal homelands one of his highest priorities. So Interior dusted off the power and began taking land into trust again.
He says the administration is more than halfway to its goal of accepting 500,000 acres in trust before Obama leaves office. Washburn, a member of the Chickasaw Nation, thanked Young for letting his views be known so voters can choose come election time.
You've made plain your concerns about tribal governments, and you've not hidden your prejudices, and I think I respect that, because although I disagree with you, and I'm glad you're not running from your convictions.
Young both scolded Washburn and showed him respect. The congressman says he wants to make it fair for all tribes that want to put land in trust.
Why would you object to that?
Well, because there's no tribe that's asking for that, Chairman. There's not a single tribe that wants you to pass a law that...
Now, wait a minute. That's not true. There are tribes that say we need to know why we were turned down. Why did one tribe, the other tribe got it, and we didn't? Because of the discretion of the secretary, the BIA.
In Alaska, a judge's order, for now, prevents the secretary from accepting land in trust, but the administration is ready with new Alaska-specific rules once the case is resolved. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, five people fall ill after eating tainted seal meat.
The toxin distributes itself very unevenly in the food, whether it's seal oil, seal flipper, beaver tail, whatever.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The state of Alaska is closing wolf hunting early in the Stampede area along the northeastern edge of Denali National Park. The emergency shutdown ends the season 2 weeks ahead of its scheduled closure. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game action follows the killing of two Denali wolves shot earlier this month on state land near a bear baiting station. A state release says bear hunting regulation changes have resulted in more hunters in the area. Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton says the situation increases the chances of wolves commonly seen in the park being taken. Individuals and environmental groups petitioned the state to take the action to better protect a park wolf population that's plummeted to 48 this spring, its lowest level on record. State Division of Wildlife Conservation Acting Director Bruce Dale says there's no biological or conservation issue. Wolf advocates want restoration of a protective buffer zone along the park's northeastern boundary. The Board of Game eliminated the wolf buffer in 2010. Five people have fallen ill or been taken under medical observation after two separate meals of fermented seal flipper in the Seward Peninsula community of Koyuk. The food has been linked to the toxic bacteria that causes botulism. KNOM's Matthew Smith has more.
According to State Department of Epidemiology officials, the first person fell ill after sharing a meal with six others in Koyuk last Friday. That patient had mild symptoms, dry mouth and dizziness, and sought medical help in Nome. No one else from that meal felt sick. A stroke of luck that medical epidemiologist Dr. Michael Cooper says makes botulism a tricky disease.
The toxin distributes itself very unevenly in the food, whether it's seal oil, seal flipper, beaver tail, whatever. There may be a part of that meal that has a very high concentration that will kill you or make you very sick. And there may be part of that same meal that has no toxin.
The first patient received a botulism antitoxin at Nome's Norton Sound Hospital. And Dr. Cooper says health officials reached out to the family in Koyuk to make sure no one else ate any more of that seal. But just 5 days later, another tainted flipper was eaten.
Two separate meals, two separate seals prepared separately. It was the same preparers involved with both meals.
The second meal was shared by four people and left one person, quote, severely ill, and led to three others being taken under medical evaluation. In all, three people, one from the first meal and two from the second, were given the botulism antitoxin.
The two others, upon further questioning, you know, they didn't have the correct symptoms, and on exam, they had a normal exam, so they were deemed not to have botulism.
Leftovers from the second meal tested positive for botulinum, the toxic spores of which cause botulism. Epidemiologists say those who ate the first meal have finished a 10-day observation period. The eaters of the second meal remain under observation. Even when prepared carefully and using traditional practices, fermented foods can pose a risk. A batch of botulism-tainted seal oil sickened dozens of people in December in the Bristol Bay region, and early last year, one man in Lower Kalskag died after eating a meal of fermented fish heads. Health officials are urging residents in Koyuk and anywhere else where fermented foods are consumed to be on the lookout for symptoms of the disease, including shortness of breath, nausea, vomiting, dry mouth, and blurry vision. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
NOAA Fisheries is seeking public comment on a draft recovery plan for Cook Inlet beluga whales. According to a release from NOAA, the plan will structure efforts to bring the whales back to a healthy population. Jim Balsiger is the regional administrator for NOAA. He says the plan was made with the best available science. It focuses on 10 types of threats to the population and assesses the severity of each threat. Cook Inlet beluga whales have been on the endangered species list since 2008. Since 2011, the inlet has been designated a critical habitat area for the species. According to NOAA Fisheries, the population is estimated to be 340 animals, and there has been a steady decline in the species over the last decade. Supporters of Medicaid expansion have continued their efforts with rallies in downtown Anchorage this week, and today an Anchorage-based political group again called on the state legislature to make changes in oil tax credits. Backbone is an activist group made up of former state lawmakers and community leaders who are opposed to current state policies regarding oil taxation. Group members positioned themselves around a table downtown today to demand that state legislators get back to work. Vic Fisher, himself a former state lawmaker, says the current legislative impasse is unacceptable. Fisher says it's a few key figures in the government who are blocking a decision on the budget.
These decisions are being made by the legislative leadership, the chairs of committees, the speaker, the president of the Senate. That's where the responsibility lies. They are the ones who have to reach out to the governor, work with the governor. They're the ones who have to work with the minority, if that's what it takes, to serve the people of Alaska.
The problem, former Anchorage Mayor Jack Roderick says, is that the legislature has lost control of the oil industry.
The legislature, I think most of this is way over their heads, except for maybe a couple of people that work for the oil companies and are key members of the legislature. And you cannot serve two masters at the same time.
Fisher says it is not a matter of changing current oil tax law, but at pinpointing the problems that exist within it to hammer out an equitable solution for both the oil companies and for the people of Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ellen Lockyer. This week on AK, Biking a Century. Have you ever thought about biking 100 miles in one go? KSKA's Ann Hillman did, so she signed up for the Clean Air Challenge. It's a bike ride the American Lung Association hosts every year to raise money for education and research on lung disease. This year's route ran from Talkeetna to the Denali Viewpoint and back. At first, Anne was in it more for the challenge of the ride than for the cause. But then, something happened along the way.
Let's set the scene here a little bit. First off, we have the main character. That's me. I'm Anne. And my quest is I'm trying to ride 100 miles in the Clean Air Challenge. Now, I ride my bike every day, but I don't ride my bike 100 miles every day. I ride my bike like 5 miles every day or 10 miles. I am not like a super biker. I'm someone who puts on jeans and heads off to try to get from point A to point B.
So the day before the ride, I roll my bike through the pattering rain and ask the volunteer mechanics to look it over.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's in good shape.
Isn't it awesome tomorrow?
That's kind of your seat post. It doesn't wiggle.
Just like, you know,
unlike most of the other bikes that people are wheeling into the parking lot, mine's a bit clunky. It's an old commuter bike souped up with fenders, a rack, and neon lights. I've hauled furniture with this thing. It is not fast, unlike the sleek carbon frame bike Sherry Price rolls up with.
You can't really, yeah, you have to use your whole hand to pick it up.
Can I
see you pick it up with two fingers? Oh God, you're picking up that bike with two fingers.
Price has been training for the event in Arizona all winter, riding 40 or 50 miles every other day. But she still says 100 miles is a challenge.
It's not an easy thing. It's a lot of endurance and, you know, everybody pulling each other along, you know, as a team, you pull and you push. So we take turns.
Her attitude is much different from Pete Adams, who rolls up with a borrowed bike.
Why a loner?
Well, I didn't have one.
Period?
Yeah.
Do you bike much?
No, I hadn't biked at all, really.
Wait.
Until about 2 months ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Are you going to do the 100 tomorrow?
Yeah. Now I'm hooked. I just bought one from her. Yeah.
You're not worried? You're not? What's the longest you done?
30 miles.
He wanders off in a glance at the seasoned bike mechanics.
Does that happen all the time? People are just like, yeah, I rode 30 miles. That's cool. Now I'm going to do 100.
Thank you.
No. Like, no one's concerned about this.
They will be at mile 70.
I suddenly feel a bit better. I'm a middle of the packer after a decent night's sleep.
Okay, this is it. The morning of the event. And I'm more tired than anything. And it's cloudy. Yep, but it's not raining.
I leave the starting line and begin trudging up the bike path out of Talkeetna. Groups of friends chat around me, greeting me as they roll past. The first 14 miles are easy, and then I hit a snag. Sitting in the middle of the bike path was a songbird that had been hit by a car. It was struggling, and there was nothing I could do to help it. No organization I could call.
So I picked up the bird, and I moved it to the side of the road, and I kept biking, and I kept thinking, you know, there's a lot of situations in life where you can't do anything. But there's a lot of situations in life where maybe you can.
I spent a lot of time thinking about that bird and why it bothered me so much. I mean, I try to be a good person. I volunteer, I recycle, I adopt pets from the pound. But unlike most of the 265 other riders, I decided to do the Clean Air Challenge for selfish reasons. I wanted the experience of biking 100 miles and knowing that if I struggled, a community of people would help me out. Fundraising to help prevent lung diseases was a side note. So for 25 miles, I thought about that bird and what it meant. And then my thoughts turned to the other riders. Some were survivors of lung cancer. Others lost family members. And it occurred to me that being here and biking and cheering on everyone around me could be that little thing I can do in this situation. By the time the steady rain set in around mile 40 and I arrived soaked at the halfway point, my thoughts had taken a less introspective turn.
Brownies, cookies.
Bikers shake with cold from the persistent rain and 40-degree temperatures. Many contemplate scratching there or at the next stop. But I climb on my bike and slowly head up the hill and back toward Talkeetna. When I arrive at the 70-mile rest stop, the lawn is a sea of abandoned bicycles. I'm soaked and cold, but determined. Finally, nearly 3 hours later, 10 hours after I started.
Anne Hillman, you just biked 100 miles. How do you feel?
Uh-huh. I feel a lot better than I thought I would. I think stopping 10 miles ago and eating some trail mix was good. But I must be sleepy because I'm a little bit out of it.
As I park my bike, Pete Adams walks up, already showered. He's the guy with the borrowed bike. He finished with no problems. So did Sherry Price. So, do I want to try biking a century again? We'll see in 2 weeks. I'm already signed up for Bike MS. For AK, I'm Ann Hillman.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Seth Landon, who also participated in the Clean Air Challenge. Landon moved to Alaska 5 years ago from the flatlands of Michigan and now calls Wasilla home.
Hi, my name is Seth Landon. I have been up here in Alaska for about 5 years now. Started working at a Bible camp and doing AV work. How I started really getting into cycling up here was the fact that I had no vehicle and still have no vehicle. I had to use a piece of junk bike to get me around town and help me get jobs. End up selling my pieces of junk and end up having some friends give me some great deals and on some pretty awesome bikes. Now I've been experiencing, like, I raced the Iditarod Trail 62 miles every year and the pure snow and cold with winds of 20 miles an hour and 20 below temps, which can make for a thrill if you don't have the proper gear. I know as a Christian, God is what makes me want to ride. Just the fact I can get out and just enjoy the quietness, enjoy the scenery. And because I'm a strong Christian, my faith, and it's kind of like my personal time with God. I go out there and just enjoy his time. Gets me away from all the distractions. Yesterday the ride was great. I was doing the 100. Well, I was trying to do the 100, but I kind of came underprepared. It became pretty miserable. I mean, it got to the point where I was having trouble see the road. People were having trouble see me, and I was getting close to hypothermic. Luckily, a rider who was actually looking out for me saw that I was not looking too good and was nice enough to remind me, hey, if I were you, I'd back out now because you're going to get hurt. So I believe I made the right decision at backing out because my health and my safety was the most key thing to me.
Seth Landon lives in Wasilla. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ann Hillman, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matthew Smith in Nome, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at LBBLawyers.com. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2015. Find out more about APU's promised tuition grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message is sponsored by APU.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.